Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Theer is back! Working from work, picking dog hair from her clothing?
I'm not.
No.
Thanks very much.
Yeah. Does he shed?
Yeah, he does.
So you probably are. I don't know if this could be too much of a thing. Someone emailed to say, I only listen to the podcast to find out about Alf.
Yeah.
So it's probably not becoming too much of a thing. How is Alf?
Give the people what they want. Alf.
You were banging on about him in the lift on the way here.
Alf is a joy. He's every hour he seems to be getting more of a character.
Does he sleep well?
He sleeps. He doesn't like bedtime.
No.
He knows it's happening. He knows it's coming and he tries to prevent it.
Yeah.
But then he reluctantly gives in. And he's very, very happy in the morning when it's over.
And this is your first day without him?
This is the first day.
How's he coping, do you think?
I think he's fine. He has a sock that he's very fond of, so that'll keep him busy.
Matt is suggesting that we have a dog cam. You should do that. Has your fella
he is
sent
beautiful.
You,
he's very photogenic.
Has he sent you videos?
I have had one video today, yes.
Had he look at it good?
Yes,
look happy.
Great. He's running.
Major. He's a dog.
He's running and his fur is flowing. Stunning.
Right, enough of that.
The dog's all right too.
Remember, you should be subscribing to the TLS to help support all of our unquenchable desire to bring you the best cultural writing in the world and to support Thea's domestic felicity. Also, Google TLS subscription now. This week, we've been ignoring Edmund Blackadder when he said, "We hate the French. We fight wars against the French. Did all those men die in vain on the fields of Agincourt? Was the man who burnt Joan of Arc just wasting good matches?" Blackadder also described being French as eating frogs, cruelty to geese and urinating in the street and going to bed with the kitchen sink if it put on a tutu. But we digress. This week, the TLS is devoted, celebrating French culture. And so is this podcast. And that includes celebrating the 400-year anniversary of the birth of Cyrano de Bergerac. Who was he? Why did he not come from Bergerac? And should we stop talking about his nose? Amazingly, Cyrano was a playwright born just 3 years before Molière, whose literary fame is rather more secure. Muriel Zaga will tell us about the man and the latest version of Tartuffe playing in London. Plus, we'll hear a poem by Stephen Knight about the four most chilling words in the English language: rail replacement bus service. It's easy to think of Cyrano de Bergerac metonymically, a large protuberant nose, the flounce of a feathery hat, the swashbuckling gait of a swordsman. That is the figure, as David Coward notes, from the bilges of literature, endlessly replicated since Edmond Rostand's play of 1897 as a multitudinous procession of self-sacrificing sozies who write poems for tongue-tied rivals to mouth to Roxanne. Did you know what sozy meant?
No, I didn't.
Doubled, like a doppelganger. Yes, great word. I'm going to use it in ordinary conversation. But there was a real Cyrano born in Paris 400 years ago this year. He does seem to have had something of a redoubtable nasal presence, which he may or may not have been sensitive about. A large nose, he sighed, is the mark of a clever, courteous, affable, generous-spirited and liberal man. A small nose indicates the opposite. But a nose is a nose is a nose, as someone nearly said, and our hero should indeed have offered rather more to posterity than that. In Coward's terms, nobody should be famous for having a nose, and the real Cyrano has other claims on our attention, not least of which is his status as a bad boy of French literature. This week we resurrect, a concept of which Cyrano was not a fond adherent, a figure filled with imagination and intellectual boldness, a rebel spirit in a conformist age. I say we, but actually David Coward has been triumphantly doing the resurrecting, and he joins Thea and me on the line now. David, hello.
Hello.
Before we get to the reality, which is fascinating, what is the popular image of Cyrano? Where does it come from? If we asked a person in the street, what would they say about Cyrano, do you think?
Well, they'd probably say who, but the general idea, I think, is that he was a rather strange man, full of poetry, full of ideas, a very strong wrist to fight his enemies. And the general idea, I think, is that he was a man who was considered himself to be unattractive to women, but was able to woo them with his words. And since he could not woo any real women, he allowed himself to woo them by proxy, by giving poems and letters to his rivals to read to the woman he loved himself. So he's a very tragic figure. I mean, in some versions, there's a very good film with Gérard Depardieu,
who could
play anything, and he makes it all very convincing. But, I mean, there are some versions of it, which are, there's a Hollywood version of about 1950, that I remember, as Oscar Wilde said, it would take a heart of stone not to laugh.
And he probably didn't have that big a nose. We've done a picture of him, and he's got a bit of a honk, but it's not. I mean, I'm not sure you'd even remark upon it if you met him in the street.
Well, I think he was sensitive about it, because I think he sort of he duelled with enemies who made observations about his nose. No, I think it was that much of an image. I mean, it's Rostand made of it, I think, and he converted poor Lord Cyrano into a kind of romantic hero who was more at home in the 1820s and 30s in French theatre than he was in real life.
And he wasn't from Bergerac, is that true?
No, not at all. Bergerac is a town in the southwest of France, whereas the Bergerac of his name came from a rather small estate that his family owned somewhere near Paris, just southwest of Paris. But the town has taken him over, of course. He's a great tourist attraction. They've got a couple of statues there, not just one, but two, which does them quite a lot of good. But, I mean, that has transformed him into, you know, a man of the Southwest, a Gascon, famous for poetry, famous for sword fighting, a kind of D'Artagnan. But in reality, he wasn't like that at all.
He was very much immersed in the Parisian scene, wasn't he?
Well, yes. I mean, he was born in Paris. He wanted to make his way. He didn't have all that much money, and he thought he might be able to do it as a soldier, but he got wounded in a couple of sieges he fought at. And then he realized that he was too poor to buy himself rank in the army. And so he tried to live by his pen, which wasn't very easy to do, especially since he had ideas which were contrary to the general tenor of the time.
Well, I want to talk about that, because you talk about his intellectual boldness and you say he was a bad boy of French literature. What were his ideas? What should we know about him?
Well, in the 1630s and 1640s, France was slowly emerging from the medieval idea that the whole of the universe and all that there is in could be understood only in terms of religion. And in the 1620s, 30s, there was a small movement of minds which said that, well, perhaps this wasn't such a good idea after all, and that why not sort of try and understand the world through science, through reason. And he said, reason is my queen. And he used his observation, his judgment, to contradict the ideas of religion. And, of course, that set him on a difficult course with the church. I mean, he didn't have terribly many positive ideas, actually, because when you think of it, most of his ideas are negative. He denied the creation. He said that there was no soul, there's no need for a god, that the universe is made of a very complicated structure of which the earth is not the center. The earth circulates the sun. The earth spins on its own axis.
I mean, he made all of these major statements going further than Descartes did, even in terms of just saying there was no God. But he wasn't a scientist. Was he mostly just reading?
No, he did it all through his imagination.
Imagination.
I mean, it's not really until the 1750, the middle of the 18th century, that you have the experimental method in scientific inquiry becoming the norm. That is to say that people observed and then they drew conclusions from observations. Before then, they put down ideas and said, "Well, this seems quite likely. Therefore, it is what is."
But he was right, wasn't he? I mean, in a lot of these things, we might have a debate about whether or not there's a God. But he's right about the Earth not being the centre of a universe. He's right, potentially that the soul's not immortal, the Bible can't be trusted. These are all things that modernity has cheerfully accepted.
Well, I think that's right, and this is perhaps a part of the problem that poor old Cyrano has. I mean, his major battles were won long, long ago, and so what is left of Cyrano is his nose.
But why is he not known as a tremendous independent mind and, you know, revolutionary thinker of his age? Because presumably this is a risky time to be doing. I mean, do we know whether the church threatened to go after him for these ideas, as you say, in the work of Galileo?
Well, now there, I mean, the manner of his death is quite interesting, because he either died of syphilis, which he contracted in about 1645, apparently, or of a large piece of wood which fell on his head. Now, it was said that the Jesuits had been responsible for this, to get him out of the way, because they couldn't answer his arguments, so they decided to remove him. I mean, the Jesuits had a terrible reputation, because you know, it is said that Molière died on stage during the Malade Imaginaire. Well, there is a story, if I may tell it. Goes like this: that he didn't die of natural causes on stage. He was drugged by the Jesuits, who then carted him off and put him in a cell, the cell that became known as the cell inhabited by the man in the iron mask, because he had to be masked because everybody recognised him, you see. Now, Molière, being a resourceful sort of chap, chummed up with the jailer's daughters. It always happens in these prison stories.
This is almost certainly not a true story, is it, David?
And they took off together and ended up down in the south of France. He changed his name for obvious reasons, when Molière was quite well known, and he called himself Monsieur Bompard. But even the south of France was too hot, so they went further. They ended up in Corsica, where the name became Italianized to Buonaparte.
Nah.
And when Napoleon came to power in 1793, this story was resurrected, and he didn't deny it, because it was quite useful to him politically, because it meant that he was a descendant of someone who'd been set upon by the evils of monarchy and the Catholic Church.
That is a magnificent story. Funnily enough, your piece in the paper this week is next to a piece by Julia Prest with the headline "Imaginary Molières and How Tall Stories Gather Themselves Around Molière." That is a fantastic one. You mentioned him having syphilis. He also, this is back to Cyrano now, said chastity cannot be a virtue since God ordained sexual congress, otherwise we would all just spring up in May like grass and roses. So because sex existed, it must be what God wanted.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I mean, so he was libertarian in that sense. I mean, that's why he's one of the bad boys of French literature. And I mean, and as a poet, not that he was much of a poet, really, he comes between about halfway between Villon and Rimbaud.
Okay. Well, let's talk about him as a writer, because it's interesting, because he was a playwright, a poet, and are these kind of short stories he wrote as well?
Yes, well, they were kind of philosophical stories, just like Candide, that kind of thing, you know, where some kind of truth is being put across in the garb of an interesting story. And his stories were designed, actually, to put forward these ideas that we've been talking about, you know, the anti-religion, that the planets are in our worlds, which are inhabited just like ours. Why not? If God could make the soul immortal, why could not God make a multiplicity, indeed, an infinity of worlds?
And he actually, there's something, when I read your piece, a sort of Da Vinci-esque thing here, isn't he? Because he's thinking
That's right. He had no scientific training. He was not really aware of scientific principles. He guessed some of them, like gravity. He was quite clear on the idea of gravity, but he might equally well have said that, you know, there is no such thing as gravity, and that the reason that we don't fall off the world is not because we are attracted by gravity to it, but because we are being repelled by the rest of the universe. I mean, that was exactly the way in which his mind worked.
Just finally, David, I suppose, why this fascinating man with all of these modern ideas Why do you think he has become associated with the way he has? Is it just the power of that theatrical presentation at the end of the 19th century, or what's the reason?
I think so. I think, I mean, there were French literature is full of people who had very strange and very amusing ideas, and in fact were in many cases groundbreakers. But in fact, they weren't in the right place at the right time. No one paid attention to them. They were from the wrong social class. They didn't make a hit. They had no proper patron to push them. There are all sorts of reasons of that sort of contingent nature that explains why these people have been forgotten.
Oh, well, I'm so glad you've taken the opportunity to remind us all about him. David Carr, thank you very much indeed.
Okay, thanks very much.
That is kind of extraordinary, Theo, when you just listen to all of these things that he was thinking of. That, because you and I were saying on the way here, I thought of a nose. I think I've watched the Gerard Depardieu thing, but I can't remember anything about it. Yeah. I can think of Roxanne, the Steve Martin movie, where Steve Martin had a really ridiculously long nose.
Yeah. There's an A.L. Kennedy novel from a few years ago, so I am glad. And it's based in modern Glasgow, Glasgow, yeah. He arrives, Cyrano arrives as this kind of figure in her house share, and he glows in the dark. And so that's another.
It sounds like he'd have liked that. It sounds like he would have liked that. But I just, when you go through, he's basically imagining all these things which turn out to be true.
Yeah. But what about all of the things that he must have imagined that turned out not to be true?
But that's good as well.
So it's his unbridled imagination, some of which has turned out right, and some of which
isn't,
presumably hasn't. Like the the cage to ascend into the sky, which involves throwing a magnet works with the cage and draws the cage up.
By fastening flasks of dew about his person and standing in the morning sun until he ascends on its warming ray.
Beautiful.
That would be, no. Good luck trying that.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This podcast is brought to you in association with Harvard University Press and an appropriately themed book of theirs. In Catherine and Diderot, The Empress, the Philosopher, and the Fate of the Enlightenment, Robert Zaretsky traces the lives of Catherine the Great and the philosopher Denis Diderot. Denis Diderot. Thank you, Thea. Inviting us to reflect on the fraught relationship between politics and philosophy and between a man of thought and a woman of action. And we reviewed it in the paper last week, and Leslie Chamberlain called it beautifully organised and very readable, which is happy, actually, because if she'd absolutely slated it, this would have been a rather awkward link. But she didn't. She really liked it, so that's very good. Listeners of the TLS podcast can order a copy of Catherine and Diderot at the special price of £15. The RRP is £20, plus postage and packaging, by emailing info@harvardup.co.uk and quoting TLS podcast. That's info@harvardup.co.uk.
Molière is undoubtedly France's most famous playwright. No other works are as frequently performed by the Comédie Française as his are, and no other French playwright has been so successfully and consistently exported. No wonder, perhaps, that the French language itself is known as the language of Molière. But he was not always so smoothly a part of the establishment. When Tartuffe first appeared in 1664, it caused a scandal, was banned by the church, and saw the Archbishop of Paris promise excommunication for anyone caught watching, reading, or performing in the play. One particularly incensed curate called Molière a demon clad in flesh and dressed up as a man. Mm. Now, a new production of that play, adapted by John Donnelly and directed by Blanche McIntyre, aims to rekindle the anti-establishment fire. Muriel Zaga went along to the National Theatre in London to see this modern Tartuffe, and she joins us here in the studio to tell us more. Welcome.
Hello.
So, as well as being France's most famous playwright, a piece that we have in the paper by Julia Prest, she's reviewing a new biography. She claims that he's also the most fictionalised of the French playwrights because so much of his life has been misdocumented or misrepresented. What do we know about his life?
Well, I suppose there's a Shakespeare parallel there, because he is so much so fundamental to the French's sort of consciousness about themselves that it's probably very tempting to fasten upon the more colourful anecdotes or apocryphal stories. I grew up believing that Molière had died on stage, and I think a lot of actors, French actors and other actors, live their whole careers with that sort of goal in mind because of this Molière story.
It's such a great story.
It's a great story.
Well, I'm going to tell you the David Coward story that we've just heard, which is that he didn't die on stage. He's arrested for his terrible beliefs, anti-religious beliefs. He's put in the same cell that previously held the man in the iron mask.
And wore an iron mask.
And wore an iron mask because everyone knew him. He then escapes with the jailer's daughter. They go down to the south of France. They then go from down and call themselves Bonaparte.
Yeah.
They go from the south of France to Corsica, where Bonaparte becomes
Bonaparte.
And then when Napoleon rocks up, it's Napoleon is seen to have been descended from the great Molière, the great anti-religious figure.
So the story rollicks on.
Yeah, that doesn't sound plausible, does it?
It doesn't. But I suppose truth is sometimes stranger than fiction.
Yeah, but also sometimes things are just made up. But, yeah. But it's an interesting point that these stories attach to him. You're not surprised that stories... So why? Why is he so significant to French culture that stories would cling to him?
Well, he is the entry point. When you're an 11-year-old child, your entry point into French literature is usually a Molière play. And that's where you begin to learn about literature with Molière.
Really?
Yes. Whereas I think perhaps Shakespeare is considered more difficult. Molière is difficult, but there's no accident that good French is known as la langue de Molière, because there is a sort of limpidity about Molière's language, which means that he is funny in a funny sort of way, very accessible in spite of all the complicated historical context, social context that needs to be re-explained for every generation. I remember as a child being dumbfounded when I realised that in the 17th century girls would be married off to whomever their parents chose. That had become a completely alien concept. But Molière is where you come to refresh yourself and reconnect with his ideas.
Because presumably so much of the accessibility of him for school children as well is farce, is just...
Physical comedy.
Exactly.
Hysterical. And,
are they funny? Because the great knock, if you're a child learning Shakespeare, is... This is the cliche, which is largely true, I think, particularly when you read it on the page. Here is a comedy, you will never laugh at it. and that's when, if you're an 11-year-old child in Britain, in English, that's kind of what you feel. Now, you might go to a play and they manage to work it, and they can get, I've been to Midsummer Night's Dream, which are tears rolling down your face, funny. But it's very hard to see that sometimes on the page with Shakespeare. Is that true of Molière, or do you know straight away when you come to, this is funny stuff?
I think it is funny stuff. I was one of those children who was taken to the Comédie Française probably once a month to see everything in the repertoire, and so I saw a lot of Molière productions when I was growing up, and they are hilariously funny. I think it's very easy to just let the language tell you what to do as an actor performing Molière, and I did in fact once when I was a student play the role of the hippochondriac.
Oh,
in
did
drag.
You?
So I think I can relate firsthand what it's like. It's really the language tells you what to do. The actions are there. It comes straight from Commedia dell'arte. So it really is about fawning about and hiding under tables and listening at doors and being discovered and, all that kind of business. I think that's what makes him accessible. The issue is often the social conventions, which are so different, which is why adaptation... And Molière himself was a great adaptator, of course, a literary adaptator, which is why adaptation and modernization is probably a strong temptation to make him even more available.
Because he's dealing with types, isn't he? I mean, so although the context, the religious context, the same is true of Cyrano, we're just talking about that, the pressures of the age, the absolute clamour for orthodoxy, having to fit in, having to follow the church's guidance. We've moved a very long way away from that, but there's still types that subsist. I mean, the great type of the hypocrites, which in Tartuffe...
The hypocrite and the gull, you know, the very gullible... I was listening the other day, listening back to another one of your podcasts where there was mention of Goop, of Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yeah. Don't start us off on that. What did you make of that? Are you anti-Goop or pro-Goop?
Goop is a very interesting object, cultural object, is it not?
Yes, it
probably, if it didn't exist, someone else would have invented it.
But a Molière character might have invented it.
I can see a line between some of Molière's characters and a certain kind of preciousness. And yes, definitely. The types are still with us. I think that's why the story of Tartuffe is still very alive, is because hypocrisy is with us all around. And perhaps it's one of the reasons why the play has been revived more recently in Britain, I think. In France, it's always on. Essentially, there's always a theatre showing it. But here,
really?
I think because of America, because of other political events, that there's been a draw towards the story of an imposter, of someone who wears the mask and sort of befuddles you into believing all kinds of nonsense.
Well, so let's talk about this new adaptation then, directed by John Donnelly. It's set in modern-day London. What's its take?
So it's set in modern-day London. It's set in Highgate specifically. So it's set among the great and the good of North London in a very lavish house. And Orgon is a very successful businessman who has dabbled in politico-financial murky dealings before what they call the last war. So we have to infer what that means.
And what does it mean? The crash? Financial crash?
I imagine so. I think that's probably where. And then, as in the original, Tartuffe was originally a vagrant, really a beggar, whom Orgon takes into his house. And I think nowadays, with a strong preoccupation with homelessness, with an ever-widening gap between the haves and the have-nots, then the figure of Tartuffe as one of the have-nots who is pressing his face against the window. And in fact, the production begins like this. Before the curtain rises, what we see is silhouettes through the windows of Orgon's house. So we are very much in that position ourselves, in the audience. And he's pressing his face against the window and looking at all these lovely things that he should have and has been denied just because he's been unlucky in the lottery of life. So that's strongly foregrounded. And then throughout the play, other homeless women, men trickle in silently and set up camp in the drawing room silently, but in a fairly menacing way, in a way that speaks of a day of reckoning. So I think that is what we're being told. And then it's not an uninteresting take. Where it's perhaps a little too forced, I think, is with the ending, where in the original play, the ending of Tartuffe is very famous. Suddenly, out of nowhere, the king, who has not been mentioned, intervenes out of the ether, and there are none of those wonderful 17th century machines in Tartuffe, but there ought to be, you know, a cloud machine with a radiant sun king descending upon the stage to stop the misunderstanding, stop the injustice, remove Tartuffe, restore the property to its rightful owner. In this version, because Tartuffe is one of the dispossessed and we are asked to feel something on his behalf, the intervention comes from the old boys' networks of the establishment to restitute property that is actually not lawfully Orgon's. So
the sense of justice is rather different in this one than it would be in the original.
It's almost inverted. Inverted. And that is interesting. I couldn't help thinking, however, that we were sitting in the august confines of the National Theatre and we were ourselves, you know, looking around. I didn't see many of the dispossessed sitting in the stalls.
No.
And there was something a little uncomfortable about being asked as the audience to join in with this moment of piety, of social piety, and what we would call nowadays virtue signalling, and then go home to our comfortable homes without giving it another thought because we had been given absolution by the play.
Is that not very much a kind of a Molière sort of device, in a sense, to kind of directly involve the audience in that way, to unsettle and to point up the hypocrisy?
That's true. Where I had a small resistance was that I thought the play had become the production, which has a lot of merit, by the way. It's very funny, pacey, smartly done. The cast are all excellent. The language is very limber. You know, all of that is good. But the play is in danger of becoming infected itself by tartufferie or hypocrisy in that moment and absolving itself of really engaging with the difficulty of the ideological context of the play, which is complicated.
And would that not have happened in the original, because the framework was more straightforward in that sense? You kind of know where the lines are.
That's true. On the other hand, at the time, I think one of the objections to Tartuffe at the time was that it wasn't the place of comedy specifically to teach moral lessons. Mm. So that was another axis of difficulty where Molière was criticised.
One of the things that people... If you ever modernise Shakespeare and you take away the language, you're kind of left with nothing. There's an argument that Shakespeare is all the language, and contained in the language is everything of Shakespeare. And if you remove that, you might as well not bother at all. Obviously, with a translation and an adaptation, you are going to lose the language. But you know the original, you've heard this one. You know, it has lines like, nobody's on Facebook anymore apart from divorcees and pedos. Just to... You quoted that, Mio, so I feel happy quoting it. But so pick that as a line and then consider the original. Do you feel precious about the original? Do you feel, I can't believe you've done that? Or is that within the spirit of it? What do you feel about that?
I think it's as well to be robust about those things. And it's great and it's very bold to drag a play like that, kicking and screaming, into the present day. It is perhaps a shame not to measure yourself against the verse. It's a shame.
Have you seen it done in English in verse?
There was a Hampton, Christopher Hampton adaptation, the first one, not the more recent one, but I think the older one, which I saw years ago, that was in verse. And Hampton is, I think, a writer who enjoys playing with those conventions. Whereas in this production, and it is actually quite a clever take, most of the play is in prose. The character of Marianne's lover, Valère, who is a... poet, pugilist, street poet in this, and probably a graffiti artist as well, although we don't see any evidence of that, but that's what I imagine he does in his spare time, says quite firmly that he's against rhyme because it's a fascist construct. So I don't know that this reflects the writer's own ideas. But then what happens is verse comes back at the very end when the police comes on stage and order is restored. So that's an interesting illustration of the fascisme de la langue, you know, at that particular point. It's funny in the moment. I would have liked something a little bit more cuisiné, you know, where we would have engaged with the difficulty of the verse a little bit more.
Yeah. Is it ever done completely traditionally? Because Shakespeare now, again, to keep the parallel, it's pretty rare, unless you go to the Globe or whatever, to get Shakespeare done. It really annoys me because all the people tend to do in Shakespeare is put it in an unnamed Balkan country, give everyone guns and make them look a bit fascist. And you think, that's modern Shakespeare, is it? And I saw an Antony and Cleopatra, and it sent me mad because they don't change the language. So they're talking about swords and sailing and stuff like that, and they're driving their tanks and waggling their guns around.
It's completely incongruous.
Yeah, why are you doing this?
I remember seeing The Merry Wives of Windsor years and years ago, done in a sort of rockabilly 1950s production with pink Cadillacs and so on. And it was well done, but you kept wondering, why on earth? Why are we doing this?
Does Molière get that same treatment?
Molière gets the same treatment, especially in the Festival d'Avignon, usually. There's always a crazy take on Molière. The Comédie Française, thank goodness, continues to keep him in his juices, you know, and produce him fairly regularly in costume.
Are they very strict like that?
They're not that strict, but I think they are... Along the lines of the Académie Française, they are one of those institutions whose job it is to preserve and conserve the repertoire.
That's so French, isn't it?
Yes.
Don't you think the idea of the preserving role of the Academy is very French?
Final question then. What Molière would you like us to do next in this country if we were going to do another one?
That's a really difficult question. I love Les Fourberies de Scapin. It's probably one of the most Italian Molière plays. I don't think it's been done very recently, or if it has, it's passed me by.
What would that be in English?
The Betrayals, perhaps, of Scapin. Yeah. Scapin is the servant. So this is the name of the servant who's in the title, and he is a wonderfully crafty servant, yeah. and it's all about the way he outplays his master. So that's always quite fun to watch. And there's a lot of physical comedy in that. It is, in fact, the first play I was ever taken to see as a school girl, and we all had a wonderful time. So that would be.
Well, let's have that, please.
Yes. Yeah, I think if this podcast is influential, which it isn't, yeah. but if it were to be influential, wouldn't it be great?
We'll see it next season.
Next season, that place. There.
Then we can all discuss it.
Lovely. Neil Wozzecker, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Poetry time now on the podcast. This week, a meditation on those four chilling words: rail, replacement, bus, service. It's by this poet, Stephen Knight. It's a beautifully controlled and obviously melancholic affair, and Stephen is on the line to read it to us. Stephen, hello.
Hello.
Tell us the gloomy thinking behind the poem before we hear it, Stephen. What brought you here and will bring many other people to the same place when they read it?
Well, I use trains quite a lot, and that's enough in itself to justify this poem, probably, isn't it? I travel through London Bridge to work at Goldsmiths, so that has its own trials, I think.
There is a melancholy here, isn't there? Because which I think all of us have experienced.
On a train, yes.
On a train. It used to be a sign of progress, the train, didn't it? I suppose in the Victorian era. Now it's just a sign of depression.
No, not anymore. No, sadly, no. I've travelled on too many trains in the past few years to ever see it as any kind of liberating or like those adverts in the, what was it, in the 80s, with the sit back and relax and play chess, and no.
Yeah. No. That's if they turn up at all.
Yeah, well, quite, if they turn up at all.
Well, I feel lots of people are going to have a reaction to this, Stephen. Perhaps you might read it to us now.
Yes, okay. Rail replacement bus service. We wait behind the yellow line. The tannoy diagnoses countless ills. The wind along the platform chills. The trains that stop are never mine. Only the hopeless disembark. All day the sun, before the sun went down, smeared its light all over town. Behind the yellow line, it's dark. Behind the yellow line, it's late. The southbound birds have given up their songs. The night is where the night belongs. Buckets and mops procrastinate. Behind the yellow line, it rains. It rains enough to build a biggish sea. The rainfall only falls on me. The tannoy up above explains inaudibly the long delay in words both crackly and grey to those who should or should not stay. The yellow line will never say.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Stephen Knight, David Coward and Muriel Zagger. Make sure you're subscribing to the paper. We really do try and make it as good as we can. Don't we, Thea?
We do.
We do. Next week's edition is a monster 52-page spring book special. So we're going to have lots to talk about on the podcast, I promise. Until then, from Thea and from me, au revoir.